Well, the focus and the attention more and more is, of course, on the Feast of Tabernacles and all of the excitement that it builds and the hustle and bustle of getting ready and preparing to go. We focus in on that. Some of you, this will be your very first Feast of Tabernacles. There are others for whom you've gone maybe a number of years. Maybe some of you have gone 20 years to the feast. There's some of you here that have gone 30 years. Not many, but I think perhaps one or two that have gone, many years. We have, over the years, however many years you've gone, whether it's been one or two, or whether it's been 20 or 25 or 30, the point is that it is a time of excitement. It's a time when our attention begins to turn in this way. And of course, some, particularly if you're approaching your first Feast of Tabernacles, you may wonder, well, what's all the excitement about, and what is so exciting, or what is so spectacular? What is, why do we do what we do? Well, I think regardless of how many times we go, we need to focus back on why we go and what is involved there. We go first and foremost because God tells us to. Now, that's a very good reason to do anything, God tells you to. Most people never take into consideration what God tells them. All you have to do is look at the state of the world today and you realize how few people really give any regard whatsoever to what God tells them. We go to the Feast of Tabernacles first and foremost because God tells us to. In the book of Deuteronomy chapter 16, God tells us in verse 16, three seasons in a year shall all your males appear before the Eternal your God in the place which he shall choose, in the Feast of Unleavened Bread, in the Feast of Weeks, and in the Feast of Tabernacles, and they shall not appear before the Eternal empty. Now on up in verse 13, God says, you shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days after you have gathered in your oil and your wine. And you shall rejoice, your corn and your wine, and you shall rejoice in your feast. You and your son and your daughter and your manservant and your maidservant and the Levite and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow that are within your gates. Now, it is emphasized that while God places a specific instruction, a specific command to the males to appear, and there are various reasons for that, because there are many times were aspects where because of distance or because of various factors that women with small children or who were pregnant or circumstances like that, there were more things that could interfere. And God did not place the same emphasis there because there were things that perhaps could stand in the way. But the clear intent is that the festival is a family occasion. We're to rejoice in the feast, verse 14. He tells us to observe the Feast of Tabernacles in verse 13. And in verse 14 he says we're to rejoice in the feast. We are our children, our son, our daughter, our manservant, our maidservant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow. 7 days you shall keep a solemn feast unto the Eternal your God in the place which the Lord shall choose. Because the Eternal God shall bless you in all your increase and in all the works of your hands. Therefore you shall surely rejoice. So we're told that we are to rejoice. We're to rejoice before God as a family. And the description here is in the context of an entire family coming before God. God tells us to appear before Him at these occasions. And in chapter 14, we have a little more detailed instruction. How do we do that? How do we manage to do all of this? Well, God tells us God defines for us in Deuteronomy 14 some things about the priorities that we are to have in life. God is the giver of every good thing, and God tells us about our priorities and what our priorities need to be. And in Deuteronomy 14 and verse 22, God says, "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year." Now, this is addressed in the context of an agricultural society where people were generally farming, but the principle holds true in whatever the circumstance, that we're to tithe of our increase on an annual basis. This is what is described. Now, this the exact application of it is going to vary. With most people in our society who receive a paycheck, then their check comes every week or every 2 weeks, or in some cases maybe every month, and it's very easy to calculate. In other cases, someone is maybe in business, and all the money they receive is not increase. Because if you sell an item for $10, you haven't made $10. What if it cost you $9 to buy it and you only made a dollar profit? You know, how much have you increased? If you bought it for $9 and sold it for $10, you didn't make $10. If you think you did, you'll go out of business in a real big, real big hurry. You'd be amazed at how you'd go in the hole making a lot of money. It's not so in the case here of increase. This has to do with the farmer in a literal sense. The farmer went out and he sowed a certain amount of seed, and whatever, however many bushels of grain he reaped over and above the amount that he sowed was his increase. Now, if you had a bad year and you reaped less than you sowed, then you didn't have any increase, did you? So God says you're to tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year. Now, various other scriptures go into tithing, and we can go all the way back to Genesis, and we see the tithe that God said was His. And in the book of Numbers, He assigned it to the Levites, and the book of Hebrews makes plain a transfer to the church today. But in the context of Deuteronomy 14, there is another tithe that is mentioned. We'll notice this here. It is not a tithe that the people took and went to the Levites. It was not something that they gave to that they brought to the Levites, but rather it is a different tithe. It is what we generally refer to as a second tithe, because it is the second tithe that is mentioned. That is also the term that the Jews historically used, that they used to refer to it. It's the term Josephus, the Jewish priest and historian of the time of Christ, uses. It's just a logical term, because it's the second one mentioned. In Deuteronomy 18:21, God said, "I have given the children of Levi all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance, for their service which they serve, even the service of the tabernacle of the congregation." So this was the tithe that this is the tithe that Abraham had brought to Melchizedek, in Genesis 14, when Abraham returned from the slaughter of the kings, and he tithed to Melchizedek as God's representative, as the priest of the Most High God. This is the tithe that Jacob recognized when he promised there at the time of his vision. You remember the story of Jacob's ladder, and Jacob promised to God, "If you will bring me back again, I will worship you and I will tithe on all the things that you provide for me." Jacob, of course, recognized that tithing was something that converted people did. His grandfather Abraham had done it, and his father Isaac had done it, and Jacob was recognized that that was something he needed to do. Now, when you read the context of Genesis, there you realize that Jacob had not entirely gotten the point. He was still trying to bargain with God, trying to kind of cut a deal as to what he would do. But nevertheless, he recognized as an ongoing practice that this was the case. When we come into the the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, we have added instructions, because now God began to work in a constituted nation. He set aside a Levitical priesthood, and the children of Israel were instructed in Numbers 18:21 that the tithe belonged, God was assigning the tithe to the Levites. He gave them that for an inheritance, because the tithe belonged to God. The Levites worked for God, and so God paid them, and the salary he paid them was the tithe of Israel, because that belonged to God. Now, when we come to Deuteronomy 14, though, we read of a different tithe. Because in verse 23 of Deuteronomy 14, it says, "You shall eat before the Lord your God in the place which he shall choose to place his name there, the tithe of your corn, of your wine, of your oil, and of the firstlings of your flock." Well, now, wait a minute. In Numbers, God said he gave the tithe. He gave the children of Levi all the tithe of Israel for an inheritance. But when you get to Deuteronomy 14, he talks about a tithe that people were to consume themselves. Not a tithe that belonged to the Levites, but a tithe that the individual retained. So here we have something that is different, a different tithe, a second tithe, as we have termed it, because it is distinct and different from that which is mentioned first. Here is a tithe that the individual was told, "You are to eat before the Eternal. You are to eat in the presence of God." That's what it means. This is something that you are to consume, you are to utilize it, and you are to do so in God's presence. And why are you to do that? The last part of verse 23, "that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always." You are to consume this tithe in the very presence of God, for the purpose of learning to more deeply stand in awe and reverence of the great God. Now, it goes on in verse 24 and says, "Look, if the way is too long, if you're a long way from Jerusalem, you're not able to carry your corn or your wine or your oil or these various items of produce that you have, then what you do," verse 25, "is you turn it into money, and you take the money." Now, that's, of course, what most of us do. I don't know that we have anybody that most of us are not involved in farming, at least on any large scale. And even those who were, it's normally a lot easier to turn it into money and take the money up there and buy what you need, rather than try to, haul all of the various things. If you were a rice farmer and you hauled a truckload of rice up there that was your tithe, I mean, I like rice, you like rice, but I tell you what, eating a whole truckload for 8 days and nothing else might begin to get a little old. You know, it'd be kind of nice. You sell it, you get the money, then you buy, not only the rice that you want, but you can buy meat and you can buy vegetables and you can buy all kinds of other things. So that's what God said. There's nothing, it's not the specific item of agricultural produce. It is the principle of it. It is the tithe of it, which may be represented either by the literal item itself or the money equivalent, which, of course, is what we use because we're primarily a money economy rather than a barter economy. So you bind up the money and bring it. In verse 26, "and you shall bestow that money for whatever your soul desires." And that's the King James renders "lusts after," and that is an unfortunate translation because it gives the connotation of something that's bad And that's not the sense of the original at all. It just means whatever you want. You know, here you've got something extra. You have more than you would normally have available at any equivalent time of the year for any other portion of a week or two-week duration. And so God says, look, you've got that. Bring it and get whatever you want. For oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink or whatever your soul desires. This is spoken of in the context of a festive meal, to be able to enjoy things that maybe we would not be able to afford the rest of the year. And you're to eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. And the Levite that's within your gate, you're not to forsake him. He has no part nor inheritance. Then we'll note here in just a little bit that in Deuteronomy 16, where it addressed this, in Deuteronomy 16, in verse 14, it says, you shall rejoice in the feast, you and your son, your daughter, your manservant, your maidservant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow that are within your gates. So, in other words, the individuals, the others, the Levites, the strangers, the fatherless, the widows, all of these feasted on the second tithe that was brought there. Is what we would term excess second tithe, is the way that we distribute it. There is, literally many, many, multiple tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars that goes out from headquarters in Pasadena every fall to enable those to be there at the feast who would not otherwise be able to do so. When you begin, you know, it really begins to mount up when you begin to spread it out over the entire nation. And this was the principle back there. It's easier for us to administer in a more centralized way because of mail and communications being what they are. At the time that this was written in Deuteronomy 14, the excess second tithe tended to be administered on a more localized level. They all went to Jerusalem, but what was involved in terms of transport, they didn't have electronic transfer of funds. You had to haul it there to Jerusalem. So the administration perhaps has slightly changed, but the principle is exactly the same, and what we do follows the principle here. Now, let's note, God tells us that this second tithe is to be saved, it is to be utilized, and how is it to be utilized? Well, it is to be utilized to rejoice before God. Now, that is one of the key things, and this is something that really ought to underlie our fundamental understanding of the festival. When you come to the feast, when I go to the feast, we are going to appear before God. Now, if we really grasp that, then it solves the problem of all kinds of things. If you realize that what you're doing in the presence of God. You know, if somebody overdrinks, somebody gets drunk, would they do that if they really grasped it? Would they do that if they were sitting right there and, you know, across the table from Jesus Christ? Would they overindulge in some way if they realized or if they thought of themselves as literally sitting there in the presence of God? Would they exercise a little more self-restraint? Would they do some of the things they do? You know, we're told here that as it makes the statement in verse 23 of Leviticus 14, you're to eat before the Lord your God, or to eat in front of the French translation of it renders it before my face, right here in front of me. That's really the sense of the original. The imagery is as though you are sitting down at a table with God, in God's presence. God says, I will place my name there. I am there in the midst. And you are coming to appear before me in the place where I have set my name. You see, in Deuteronomy chapter 12, let's notice in verse 5, it says, unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put His name there, even unto His habitation shall you seek, and there shall you come. And there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes and all of these things. In verse 7, there you shall eat before the Eternal your God, and you're to rejoice in all that you put your hands to, you and your household. In verse 11, it says, then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause His name to dwell there, and there shall you bring all that I command you. And verse 12, you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your men servants, maid servants, Levites, and this is to be done at the place where God has chosen. In verse 17, you may not eat thereof within your gate the tithe of your corn, of your wine, of your oil, of the firstlings of your flock, or your herds, but you are to eat them, verse 18, before the Eternal. In other words, it is not something that is to be utilized in our own way for our own things apart from our appearing before God. God says that God tells us to set aside this that we might have it to participate in a festival with Him. We are to travel and come before Him. And in the presence of God, we are to take part. We are to rejoice. We are to engage in a festive occasion. We are to engage in a celebration before God, in the very presence of God. Now, that's the concept we need to have as we're coming to the feast, and it's something we need to convey to our children. That we're coming there to appear before God. And as we grasp that, it solves problems of behavior. It solves problems of all kinds of things. Because if we grasp the concept that we are coming into the presence of God. Now, we do that every week when we come here on the Sabbath. You know, we're coming to appear before God in a formal sense. Here, on these annual occasions, these annual convocations where we travel and we appear before God in the annual festivals. Now, primarily, the emphasis is on the Feast of Tabernacles because that involved a lengthy journey. But there was also a matter for the other festivals, you know, on the Feast of Trumpets. You're going to travel to Baton Rouge, most of you. Some perhaps will go to Lake Charles. But primarily, you'll be traveling to Baton Rouge. You'll be making that trip to appear before God. And there's extra expense involved, going out to eat because you're going to be away from home, or perhaps you're going to, buy some special things and bring with you, or whatever your plans are. Maybe go out after the afternoon service. You're going to be away. There's something special that's involved. That's certainly appropriate. You're coming to utilize a portion of this festival tithe, or second tithe, for the expenses involved in celebrating the Feast of Trumpets. There's nothing wrong with that. It is a part of appearing before God. We come down to, primarily we use it at the feast. We have our primary expenses, of course, would involve our transportation there, our food, our lodging expenses. Those are the primary things that we have and the things related to that. God says whatever we want, it's described whatever we want in the context of celebrating the feast. Now, it's not something, what I think I'd like is a new couch for my living room. I'll buy that. That says, buy whatever you want. Well, you're not going to be hauling that all the way to the feast, so you can sit on it for 7 days. That's not really being utilized to celebrate the feast. That's the sense of it. Now, sometimes there are items that may be used in the sense of celebrating the feast. It's not wrong to perhaps buy a small gift for family or close friends. You want to get something special for the feast, but it ought to again be something that has some connection with the feast. It is not something that would be I'm going to get my wife a feast gift. I'm going to buy her a television set, or I'm going to buy her a new microwave for her kitchen. Well, that's not really for the feast, is it? That's kind of looking for an opportunity to circumvent. God says here that this is to be used to celebrate the festival. Now, there are a lot of things that can be gotten. Sometimes even, it's not wrong. It shouldn't be the time when we do our year's worth of shopping, but on the other hand, sometimes even a special item of clothing. We're going to wind up in services every day for 8 days, and sometimes what we have is not, maybe for ourselves or our children. We want to get something special, something that is going to be appropriate for services, something that we have not maybe been able to afford and have been able to get by without it through the year. But now that we're going to the feast, we're going to be going to church every day, there's a need for that. So we say, I'm going to get this, and it's taken there to the feast and used in the context of the feast, and not that it can't be used afterward, but it's for the feast. Well, there's nothing wrong with that as long as it's done in balance and in the proper way. There are a lot of things. I remember years ago when our boys were very small, and we were going to Big Sandy for the feast and camping. And if I remember right, we were down on either 23rd Street or 26th Street that year. I forget. But I know it was way down at the bottom of the hill. Well, I came up with what I thought was a tremendous idea for a feast gift for my children, both of whom were very small. And my wife, I think, felt like it was as much a feast gift for her as it was for them, because we got them a wagon, and we took it up there, and when we got up to the feast, we got it out of the box and assembled it and put it together. Now, that was a very practical feast gift, because when it came time to go to services in the morning, we loaded the kids in there. We loaded the Bibles and the diaper bags, and, this wagon was heaped up, and then we could pull it up the hill. And you got up there, and there was a whole, like a hitching post of red wagons up there by the tabernacle building. They almost had a separate, they could have made a separate parking lot out of it. I mean, you just had dozens of these things. A lot of people had thought of that. That was something that we got some use out of at the feast. The boys, of course, enjoyed it and continued to enjoy it for several years thereafter. I think for at least a couple more feasts until they got on up big enough that they could walk all the way up there and help carry some of the things. We used that for several years there. So there are things that can have a practical value that can also be fun or can be enjoyable, to get things that can enhance the festival, that can make feast time a special time. The things that God says to spend it on are things that are in the context of the feast. Now, there was an article in a recent Worldwide News. There was an article by Mr. Joe Tkach Jr. On the subject of second tithe and the uses of it, and I won't go into all of the details there, because you have that article and you can go back and review that if you have specific questions. It's rather detailed, but I think we see the concept, we see the principle.
that God wants us to rejoice. He wants us to come before Him and to rejoice and to celebrate in this occasion. And He tells us to prepare for it. You know, how does the world prepare for Christmas? Well, as you get on, we won't be back from the feast good before there be advertisements. Take out your Christmas loan with us. Or these stores will tell you, come on, you can buy your gifts for Christmas and you don't have to start paying until 1990, which, of course, is only 1 week after Christmas, but it sounds a long way off. You know, you don't have to pay a dime until 1990. Boy, people think, that's a long ways away. So they get to use it for a week, and then they start paying. And so they advertise this, and people will pay all year. And about the time of next Christmas, they'll just be gradually getting out of hock for this one, and then they'll go in debt again. And they're always behind the eight ball, and it's this kind of thing. Well, that's not the way that God wants us to manage and to celebrate our festival before Him. He tells us to make preparation, to prepare ahead. And He tells us how to do it. He tells us to set a priority here that involves setting apart this that will enable us to celebrate the festival before Him, to come before Him, to appear before our God. And that's what we're coming there for. We're coming to appear before God, to come before Him and to learn of His ways. Now, there are two reasons to go to the feast. We go to appear before God, and we go to appear before God for two reasons. In Deuteronomy 14, we're told what they are. Latter part of verse 23, that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. First and foremost, we go to the feast that we might learn to fear our God, to stand in more deep awe of God. That's what it means to fear God. It doesn't mean you go run, hide, and... It's talking about a deep reverence, standing in awe of God, being greatly impressed with God. In other words, we should come away from the feast more deeply impressed with God, with His greatness and His power, with who and what God is. That's the first reason that we go to appear before God, that we might learn to stand in more complete awe of Him, that we might learn to fear the Eternal our God always. And then on down to the last part of verse 26, we're told that we're to eat there before the Eternal our God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. We're told that we go to the feast to rejoice before God. God wants us to have a good time. He says, you can't go to the feast and be a grump. It says so right here. It says, you shall rejoice. So, you can't go there and just be grumpy all the time. God doesn't want us to do that. He wants us to rejoice. He wants us to have a good time. God is not against a good time. But He wants that good time to be a lawful good time, to be an appropriate good time, to be a good time that is within the confines, within the context of His law. The world thinks that when you have a good time, you got to go out and really tie one on, and then you come in the next day and you get ashes smeared on your forehead, and you're ready to really mortify the flesh for 40 days to kind of suffer because you really, boy, you really celebrated. I mean, you made a you really went all out. And that's kind of their idea, see? That they assume that if you're going to celebrate, you're going to go to excess, you're really going to go overboard, and so then you kind of come in bleary-eyed the next day and you're really feeling it, and you feel like having a few ashes smeared on and kind of walking softly for a little while. Don't want anybody to make too much noise because your head hurts or whatever it is. Well, this is the world's concept that a good time always ends up with a headache and a hangover. and a guilty conscience. Well, that's not the kind of good time God wants His people to have. God wants us to have the kind of good time that's good when you're enjoying it, and the next morning when you wake up, you feel good, and you look back, and you have a pleasant memory, and you think, that was wonderful. You know, that was really nice. And you enjoy it, and you look forward to those things. God describes the festival in the context of the family, and the family rejoicing together. And we have a variety of activities that go on at the feast, and there are activities for young people, and there are activities for senior citizens, and there are various things that go on, but the primary thrust of it needs to be a family-oriented festival. We go to the feast, and we're going to appear before God as a family. And it's certainly appropriate and proper that families would normally sit together at the feast. And what would be totally inappropriate is for, you know, groups of children, unsupervised and away from any family, to be kind of sitting off by themselves, you know, up in the top of the bleachers, making noise and cutting up. That should never happen. Unfortunately, some of that used to happen. I remember years ago in Big Sandy, we had some difficulty with that. And at that time, There were no bathrooms in the old tabernacle building. There are now, but there were no bathrooms in the tabernacle building. And people had to go, if you had to go to the bathroom, you remember, those of you up there, you had to walk down to 4th Street on the campground where the first set of bathhouses were. And, you know, it was amazing how many people needed to go. And we would have problems because some would come up there and their parents' families were not properly chaperoning them. And they'd get in there, hey, I'm going to go sit with so-and-so. So they'd kind of turn loose, and they'd get in one door and go out the other. And my friendly crew and me met them on 4th Street. And somehow we were not real impressed with all these stories of people who had forgotten their Bible and their notebook and needed to go back down in the camp to get it, you know, because you could tell by the looks that and the general tenor of things that getting their Bible to take notes and look up the scriptures and services was really the least of the concern. And so we had you know, a lot of people who were making a very quick round trip going back into the tabernacle. Well, you know, in one sense it was absolutely ridiculous that we had to do that, but it was because some parents were not being responsible. And we had to deal with that. I think that that has not been the problem in recent years that it was at one time. But we need to take heed. We need to continually seek to upgrade, to realize we're going to appear before God. We're going to rejoice before God as a family. And a part of the blessing God has given us is our family. We want to do things together and do things the whole family will enjoy. You know, to consult the children and to talk to them about things. Where would you like to go? What would you like to do? What are some of the special things you want to do this year? And to plan some things that the whole family will enjoy, and not just for Dad to plan the things that he will enjoy, and everybody else can kind of go along for the ride or sit in the room and sulk or whatever they want to do. Or just kind of be turned loose and go somewhere and see what they get into. But to think in terms of what's everybody going to enjoy and to give different ones a chance for some input. And maybe the kids will enjoy something that is no big deal to you. You're not that excited about doing it, but it's going to be important to them. So good, let's go ahead. Let's try it. Let's do things in that way. We go there, God tells us, to learn to fear Him more fully and to rejoice before Him. Now, in learning to fear God, you know, the book of Proverbs is filled with information about fearing God and defining what that means. We're told in Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10 that the fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom. It's the starting point. It is the essential prerequisite. The fear of God. Standing in awe and reverence of God. That's a starting point if you're going to be wise. That's where you start, with standing in awe of God, being impressed with God. God wants us to come away from the feast more deeply impressed with Him. If we're going to have a successful feast, then a successful feast is measured by, one, how much we have grown in the fear of God, you know, first and foremost, and secondarily, the extent to which we have rejoiced before God as a family. And God wants us to rejoice, to enjoy the good things that He has blessed us with. He tells us, in terms of learning to fear Him, in Proverbs 14, in verse 26, in the fear of the Eternal is a strong confidence. His children shall have a place of refuge. The fear of the Eternal is a fountain of life, to depart from the snares of death. To stand in awe of God is not to be cowering in a corner somewhere. There is a strong confidence. When you stand in awe of God, when you're impressed with God and you realize how great and how wonderful and how powerful God is, you realize the most wonderful and powerful and greatest supreme being in the entirety of the universe loves you and cares for you and is there to help you and to watch over you and to bless you and wants to help you. And if God is for you, who can be against you? There's a strong confidence that comes from standing in awe of God and knowing who God is. The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life, to depart from the snares of death. The things God tells us to leave alone are not things that are going to help us. The things God tells us to leave alone are things that are going to harm us, things that are going to pull us down, things that will destroy us. God wants us to participate in what he describes as a fountain of life, to reap the benefits and the blessings. We're told in Proverbs 16:6 that by the fear of the Eternal men depart from evil. By really standing in awe of God, we turn away from sin. The more totally, the more deeply, the more completely we stand in awe of God, the more we turn away from sin. We come to God. We come there to receive instruction. You know, the primary reason we come is there to receive instruction. God tells us in Deuteronomy 31, and verse 10, Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release, in the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel is come to appear before the Eternal your God in the place which he shall choose, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men and women and children, the stranger that's within your gates, that they may hear, that they may learn, and fear the Eternal your God, and observe to do all the words of this law. God said the whole family was to be there, gathered together. You know, people notice sometimes, first time they come into God's church, that the whole family is there. You've got the adults, and you've got the children, you've got the little children. Everybody is there. We're all gathered together. Why do we do that? Well, God said, gather the people together, men, women, and children. Pretty plain to me. Why we don't go, shunning them off somewhere. We teach our little children. We need to be teaching them and instructing them from the time that they're very tiny. It's very tiny. They learn we begin to teach them to show respect in church. Now, the way maybe a small baby begins to learn to show respect in church is that he goes to sleep and he learns to be quiet, not to make a lot of noise. And we work with them and we try to train them and teach them in these ways and prepare them. And those who have young children, there are ways of doing that, and you can sometimes, I know it can get pretty exasperated. Talk to some of those older members who have been in the church for many years and who have raised up children in the church, and get counsel and advice from them as to how they taught their children when they were little babies, because there are some here, many of those who have been around for years some of the deacons and different ones who have raised up children from infancy in the church and whose children are now grown. And you can gain some insight and some wisdom as to how did they teach their children, how did they deal with their children when they were very small and they were bringing them as little babies. So it's a matter that we can learn from one another. But God says the whole family appears together. We appear there, we come together, and the law was read before all Israel in their hearing. And we are there that we may hear, that we may learn, and that we may fear the Eternal our God and observe to do His words. So, we learn to fear God, we come there and we assemble before God. We come and we listen to the sermons. Now, that may seem elementary, but we go to the feast, certainly to attend services. You know, it makes no sense to go to the feast and plan on skipping services here and there. We go to the feast, and unless prevented by illness, we certainly ought to plan on attending every single service. And that's why we're there. It's just kind of boggled my mind sometimes to find in the past there are those that seem to assume that they were, not very many, just maybe a handful, that they were there for some other reason. They didn't see the need of being there for all of them. Well, if it's possible for us to do so, and I realize sometimes illness comes in and someone is sick and not able, and that's of course clearly understood. God recognizes the limitations of the flesh, but we need to be doing what we're able to do and the best that we're able to do. We're told in Deuteronomy or in Leviticus 19:30 that we are to hallow God's Sabbath and to reverence His sanctuary. That's a part of something we ought to be teaching our children. To reverence God's sanctuary means to show respect to where God has set His name. That ought to carry over into the showing respect. One of the ways we show respect is that we don't leave a lot of litter, or frankly, we shouldn't leave any litter. Why should people have to come in behind us and clean up under our chairs? And sometimes small children, maybe they'll have a little book that they're drawing on or something that they're coloring on. We need to be very careful when we give our children something like that. One, we need to make sure that they're being supervised, that they don't quit coloring on the book and start coloring on the floor. Little kids, somebody doesn't teach them. They may think, floor looks like that'd be a good place to color too. It's kind of got a red color. I think that color looked real nice on that tile, so they start going away. Well, we need to be keeping an eye on them. And if there's a problem, we need to straighten it up. We need to do whatever. Or they may sit there and tear off a little bit of paper, or there may be some little scraps of something. We need to check and to make sure that is taken care of. We don't want to leave something for somebody else to have to come in behind and do. That's a way of serving. Mr. Tijan was talking about serving. That's certainly a way of serving, is not making extra work. And can carry over in all kinds of things. We try to be neat and clean and to clean up after ourselves, and teaching our children that, and showing respect for God during His services. That's an important concept. We are there to rejoice before God, to have a good time. God wants us to have a good time. There's nothing wrong with rejoicing. God does not delight in His people just going around with this real dejected look on their face all the time. God wants us to be happy. Joy is one of the fruits of God's Spirit. God is joyful, and there's joy in His presence. We're picturing a time of joy for the whole world. God says in Ecclesiastes 3:1, to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. There's a time and a place for all kinds of things. And notice on down in verse 10 what Solomon wrote. He said, I have seen the travail which God has given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He has made everything beautiful in His time. Also, He has set the world in their hearts. He has set eternity in our hearts. God has given us a concept of something a lot greater and a lot bigger than what we go through here and now. We go through day-to-day life, but God has set in our minds an awareness of the future and of the past, an awareness, a concept of something that stretches out way beyond the here and now. No man is able to find out the work which God makes from the beginning to the end. You know, God has set in our hearts and our minds a concept of something bigger than we are and bigger than the here and now, and that desire to understand, and yet none of us are able to fully grasp eternity and everything that God has done from beginning to end. But He's made everything beautiful in its time. In verse 12, I know that there is no good in them, in this life, or in the things that we go through day by day, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. You know, he says, in other words, look, what is good about the life that we go through and that we live right now? Well, what's good, what's appropriate is to do good in your life, to do things that are helpful to others, to enjoy the fruits of your labor, to eat and to drink with your family, to be able to do things and to enjoy, to reap the benefits of the things you have. So God wants us to do that. He wants us to rejoice before Him, and He wants us to have that sense of joy, that sense of rejoicing. We can ensure that we fulfill the things that God has for us if we will if we will apply these principles, if we'll take these things and do them. We need to be conscious of what we're picturing and understand what we're picturing as we come there to the feast. In Isaiah 25 and verse 6, speaking here of the time of the Feast of Tabernacles, God says, the time that the feast pictures, which is the world tomorrow, in Isaiah 25, verse 6, in this mountain shall the Eternal of Hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees well refined. And He will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all people, and the veil that is spread over all nations. God is going to remove the veil, the spiritual veil that people don't grasp and don't understand the truth of God, the plan of God, the purpose of God. The world doesn't really understand. But God is going to remove that veil. He's going to take away that shrouds people's understanding, to where the whole world is going to be able to participate in a feast of fat things. We look at the world and we see that the whole world groans and travails. The world's in agony. The world suffers. All you have to do is watch the evening news, and you see over and over again the pain, the tragedy, the trauma, the heartache of people around the world. All of the things. The time is coming when God is going to make a feast of fat things for the whole world. And He's going to remove that covering that shrouds their understanding. And the truth of God and an understanding of that is going to be opened up to all people. In Isaiah 32 and verse 1, it's a time when He says, a king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment. It's a time in verse 15 when the Spirit will be poured out from up on high, and the wilderness will be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field will be counted for a forest, and judgment will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field, and the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness quietness and assurance forever, and my people shall dwell in peaceable habitations, and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. A time when, as God describes in Isaiah 14, that all the world is at rest and they break forth into singing. A time when the knowledge of God will cover the the earth as the waters cover the sea. We look forward to what we're picturing. We need to keep in mind what we're picturing, why we're there. And if we keep that in mind, we're going that we might learn to stand more deeply in reverence and awe of God, and we're going there to rejoice before God. We're picturing a time when the whole world will rejoice before God. We're picturing a time of God's blessing and God's abundance. We want to be conscious of what we're picturing. We want to be sure that we are picturing it in the way that we celebrate this festival. Not celebrating a selfish feast, not celebrating a feast that just focuses in on the self and on going to excess, but a feast that is a spiritual feast, a feast that is a giving feast, a feast that is a balanced feast. We want, in the context of our preparations, to be spiritually prepared, to be praying about the feast, praying and asking God's inspiration and guidance for all of those involved in the festival. And certainly praying for God's inspiration of Mr. DeCotch as he prepares a message for all of us that will be we'll all receive live by satellite hookup on the first holy day. Pray for the inspiration of all of those who speak, all of those who carry out the various activities at the festival. Praying about the feast, studying related subjects in our Bible, getting our minds focused in on it, thinking about it, praying about it, preparing ourselves spiritually that we might go to learn to fear our God more deeply and more completely. We prepare physically. God gives us instructions to prepare all year as we set aside a second tithe, a tithe to enjoy the festivals, and certainly all of the festivals, but the Feast of Tabernacles primarily, because that's usually the greatest travel and the greatest expense. There are all kinds of things, of just even making physical preparation of checking over things, making our lists and checking them twice, and maybe more than that if you're like me, because you probably left something out. I remember various things that I left out over the years, but to go through and to think about these things, if you've not been to the feast before, talk certainly to those who have and get some ideas, get some suggestions. Even if you have been to the feast before, maybe you're going to a different site. Talk with them. Talk with other people. Get ideas. Get suggestions. There are many helpful suggestions in the festival issue of the Worldwide News. There are a lot of things. There are articles that give a lot of very specific suggestions. They're there for us to take and to read and to heed these admonitions. We want to be careful. We look to God for protection and blessing, but we don't want to be tempting God. We don't want to be foolish and careless, driving some great, long, excessive period of time, getting involved in things that we want to get our spiritual priorities straight. Do what we need to do spiritually and plan things out and take an approach that it will all come together. We want to go prepared to give and to serve in a balanced way. In a right way, to go and sign up for everything there is to sign up for, and be going from daylight till midnight, and being involved in so many activities where you can't go to services because you're over here doing this, over here doing that, over there doing something else. Well, that's not balance. It's not going to an extreme, getting involved in so many things that you can't handle your responsibilities and your priorities properly, but it is not having a selfish feast. And there are things that all of us can do to serve. Mr. Tijan pointed that out, that our circumstances vary. Some of us can do certain things, others can do other things, but we all have a contribution we can make. And we want to be conscious of this. We want to be conscious of what we're doing. We want to ensure a great feast, a wonderful feast, the kind of feast that God wants us to have, the kind of feast that is a foretaste of the world tomorrow. And realize that the prime thing that is a foretaste of the world tomorrow, the primary aspect of the feast, is not the amount of second tithe you have, is not how big a steak you eat, or those are not the things that really determine the ultimate success of the feast or the extent to which it pictures the world tomorrow. It's to what extent is it a spiritual feast, a giving feast, a serving feast, a helping feast, a feast that as we try to give joy, as we try to give a good time, as we try to help and to encourage and to bolster one another, as we try to give of ourselves, just in visiting and fellowship and in companionship and in doing these things, we are producing the results that God would have us produce, and we're setting the stage for the most successful kind of feast that it is possible to have. So, as we focus in on these things, we want to get our priorities straight. We want to understand the overall concept that God wants us to get across, wants to get across to us, and wants us to grasp. And we focus in on these things, and we prepare for it, and we anticipate the best that it is possible to have, and that is the kind of feast as we go before our God, appearing in the presence of God, coming before our God to learn more of His ways, to assemble before Him, to learn more deeply of His ways, to stand more deeply in awe of Him, and to rejoice and to have a good time, and to look forward to the time when the whole world is able to take part in a joyous feast.